I have two notes here. I have 7 or 9 slides, depending on how many I want to get to. But they're just to remind me what I want to talk about. But if you have any questions or comments, that's more important. So just stop me. And I can make all this available. I got this data from Kathy Davis and Rhonda Hall and Susan Brown and Colleen Morgan. And this last year, there were 216 graduates, undergraduate graduates. And about 25% are actuarial science. And we're highlighted there as option one because that's what we're talking about today, is the actuarial program. And italicized, Mark Daniels talked about the teaching option. So here's my first little disclaimer. Please just use these numbers, even though I think they're 100% accurate, but they're just kind of a gauge, if this makes sense. I don't know how many actuarial students we are, how many we have. A lot of our students might be, their first major might be in finance. I think some of our best students this year, one is in economics, which is in the College of Liberal Arts, and someone's in finance. So there are 55 somehow denoted that graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Mathematics, option one, actuarial science. And of these 55, and Leslie's here to correct me, I think maybe 30 to 40% of them are going to be actuaries, and the remaining are going to do something else. So we have a lot of graduates, but they're not all going to be actuaries.
So the 216, that was the number of math.
That's the 216 over the last 3 semesters of graduating.
Oh, I see.
128 May, 66 in December, and 22 this August. And again, I don't know how to count people, because I'm sure the same thing is in education, whatever their major is.
Wait, so 3 semesters, you mean, so that's just one calendar
year? One calendar year, this last calendar year.
216 graduates.
Yeah, in math.
Okay.
And that's 100% accurate of what I've been told, so. Yeah. No, I actually, they're actual names and stuff. So the only thing I can really tell is we had 4 applied mathematics students. I want to teach in that program. Anyway, these are the jokes, people. You need to laugh. All right. So also, this was stolen from a slide with some recruiting that Mark and I do in the summer, talking to some students about the different math programs, but with more information added. So are there any questions here?
I forgot. What was the 32, 21, and 2?
So this is how many graduates there were in May of 2011, how many were there last December and in the summer. And originally there are percentages, and I was going to tell you how many graduates, but I might as well just tell you who the people were. And here's, what do I want to say? Ideally, that number would be 0. There shouldn't be any actuarial students graduating in the summer. Because there aren't any actuarial classes, so they'd be taking like one class to like their last 3 credits or something. Our program is set up. What else do I want to say? Our program is set up so you could graduate in 4 years, but then if you change of major or something, that often throws the big wrench. So are there questions on this before I go on? This is not my talk. This is you guys.
Do you know the 4-year graduation rate?
For who? Which people?
These 55 people.
Do I know how many of those 55 graduated in 4 years? No, but what a great question. Would you like some candy? What is the 4-year graduation?
The second grade that would be interesting, which is the number who started out thinking they were actuarial science majors and then graduated in some degree at actuarial science or something else, because we have a high attrition rate.
Right, and that's probably one of our biggest issues. Is I told we kind of have 2 types of students. We have those are going to be actuaries, and those are the great students that everyone loves because they do well in class and they are smart and they work hard. And then we have others, and that dichotomy kind of poses something. So, other questions before I go on? We can come back because it's a PowerPoint. I can just push the arrow back and forth. So I'm going to try to go to the next slide. Okay, I thought maybe I would start how I start with everybody. Who knows what actuaries are? 1.5? All right. So I'm going to do this anyway, just for everybody.
That's because you told me.
Actuaries tend to work in about 3 different types of business. Here's what an actuary does. An actuary is the person who figures out how much you should pay for auto insurance, for example, or how much someone should pay for homeowners insurance or life insurance.
So they're
bastards. No. We discriminate, right? I want to charge you the right amount of money. So here's the neat thing about actuaries. You can't guess. I mean, you guess a little bit. But if I am too conservative and charge you a lot of money, then you'll go to a different insurance company. You will. And if I'm too aggressive and don't charge you enough, then you'll get in a lot of accidents and I won't have enough money to pay you. So I need to pay you the right amount of money, or charge you the right amount of money. So actuaries figure out what the right amount should be, and then the business people decide what to actually charge you. So about half the actuaries work in some sort of insurance field, life insurance or annuities, auto, health insurance, homeowners insurance, long-term disability insurance. Maybe 40% of the actuaries are consulting actuaries. A lot of them are... Do you guys know what a defined benefit pension is? We have one here. The Texas teacher system is a defined benefit plan. There was a law in 1973 that said you have to be qualified to say that there's enough money in the pension plan. So that's an enrolled actuary. So that kind of that law gave birth to some demand for actuaries. But now there are fewer and fewer defined benefit pension plans. Do you guys know why? They're not all underfunded. I have a great example of a Washington State Silver Miners Union pension plan that was overfunded. It was 250% funded. And they were doing union negotiations, and the union chief wanted more money put in the plan. And my friend was working on these negotiations. And his job was to talk to the union chief, who may have graduated the 8th grade, to let him know that there's lots of money, and you don't get to use integration by parts or anything when you're describing this. And the reason why there was a lot of money in this defined benefit pension plan is because miners don't live very long. Well, that's the reason. So I don't need to have a lot of money to promise to pay you pension plans. Now, faculty, we hang on. we hang on. All right. And then there's some other, like I have an actuarial credential, but I'm not an actuary. The government hires some actuaries. And then the 2 main actuarial professional organizations are trying to grow the types of jobs that actuaries do. So here's a nice question I ask my students. I just patted myself on the back. I could ask them to find the average age of students in class. Do you think they'd get the answer close? Really? I think that they'd underestimate by a half a year. That's not close. I would like all the retirement, the Social Security benefits.
19 and a half, right?
Right. Yes. Yeah, so they'll say they're 19, but they're. I'd say happy birthday then. Mm-hmm. You're not 19. Mm-hmm. And look, if you really underestimate the average age of the population by a half a year, some billions and billions of dollars in Social Security benefits or something. Just for example, just by being wrong, by only a half. All right? Here is my favorite one. I ask new students, what is an actuary? And they say, business professionals who use math to control risk. Okay, great. What's risk? And they don't know what risk is. Do you guys know what risk is? Yes? No, that's a measure of risk, and there's some other measures of risk, like default probabilities. Like, hopefully you'd want an insurance company that could survive a 200-year event or something like that. You don't want your company to go broke. People get sad. Governments have to do bailouts, those sorts of things. All right, so standard deviation is risk. Here's good and bad. The Jobs Radar Almanac generally ranks the actuary as the number one or two or three profession in every edition based on a bunch of lies. Well, so in 2000, so there's often a new, like a hot number one for a couple years. It was biologist once even, and then it went down. But actuaries one or two or three, and they judge them based on like stress and job security and work environment and starting salary and salary growth, those sorts of things. And those are all accurate after people have passed their actuarial exams. Then there's no stress. It's kind of like being a teacher is great after you've done everything that you need to do to be a teacher, professor, yes? So those are kind of fibs, and this gets me in trouble. So I'm back to my 55 graduates, about 20 of them are going to be actuaries. The other 35, their parents think an actuary is a great profession. That's kind of an issue. So here's the neat thing when I'm talking
to... what the other 35 do?
Yeah, I don't know what they do. Pump gas? I really don't know. I don't know what the... you guys can answer. If someone gets a BA in math, what do they do? That's a real question. Some of my students still, they want to be actuaries, but so I should talk about this one right here. Actuarial companies want you to get a credential, some letters after your name, and to do that you have to jump through some hoops, which we'll get to. So prospective employers judge if you can get through all of these hoops, if you've passed actuarial exams and probably your GPA. And that gets bright, motivated people lots of interviews. And then the actuarial company interviews the student. Does that make sense? So if you don't have exams passed, you're not going to get interviews, you're not going to be an actuary. Just because you have exams passed doesn't mean you're going to get to be an actuary. They're going to interview your communication skills and if you could fit well into the company. So again, it's like a conditional probability in my head. Actuaries get paid a lot. They get paid a lot, but because they're good. So a student might want to get paid a lot, and they will if they're good. Does that make sense? And if not, then no. I always tell students I would like to be a football player. Well, I'm not good enough. Right? So did I have anything about the degree that you need here to get into the profession? You can have any degree. You can go to any school. I like this. So any school. Prove that you're smart and you have good communication skills, and then you will be fine.
But you would need a degree.
Yeah, yes. I think gone are the days when you don't need a degree at all. A bachelor's degree. And a master's degree doesn't help. You're not more valuable if you have a master's degree. Right. And Leslie's here for the main purpose of correcting my mistakes. Okay. And the exception is?
The exception is that among the people who do not become actuaries, we are overrepresented among our international students. And basically, a lot of companies don't want to try and hire an international student because they're going to need to sponsor them for a visa. And there are two different pools, I'm told, of visas, depending on whether or not you have a graduate degree or an undergraduate degree. And so, in fact, increasingly, we're having more and more of our undergraduate students wanting to go to get a graduate degree because it puts them into a different pool. Mm-hmm. Or some of them then go on and do something completely different, but some of them actually do it with intent of employing. So, if you're not a permanent resident, and so you're trying to get a job, you may well want a master's degree.
Yes, that's true. There are two main accrediting organizations in North America. There's the Society of Actuaries. That's the largest one that has currently, about 23,000 credentialed members. So, for example, I have an associate in the Society of Actuaries. Those letters after my name. I'm one of those people. And there's a smaller society called the Casualty Actuarial Society. And there are about 5,400 total credentialed people. Now, lots of students are working their way towards these credentials, if that makes sense. But still, of people who are actuaries, there are only about 30,000.
In the country? In
North America, so Canada and the United States. Are there other questions on this before?
What's the CERA?
This is a new credential the Society of Actuaries has. It's called the Chartered Enterprise Risk Analyst. And I think this is the Society's goal to grow the types of jobs that actuaries do, as opposed to just working in life insurance and pensions. It could be for any company.
So they're assessing business risks then?
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
So and this could be an entry into the financial industry?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's their goal. The Society of Actuaries is larger, and that has more of the life insurance. The people who are working in life insurance would pursue these credentials. I say property and casualties, auto insurance or homeowners insurance, people would pursue these credentials. Now, the neat thing for our students, the credentialing process is about the same initially. So you would get... Okay, we'll go on and we'll come back to this slide if we need to. Oh, now I'd like to thank Jim Daniel for this slide. And also Mark for inspiring me to talk about the history of the actuarial program at the University of Texas. And I use this old-time script, right, for the history. That was my thought. So someone I don't know, Edward Dodd. Here's the joke. I'm sure that you taught with him for several years, Ted. Edward Dodd occasionally taught some actuarial-type math classes. I have the titles here, but I don't know the material that was in them. And I don't know what occasionally means. And then in around 1950, Ralph Lane, I guess, developed an official program. But there was only about one student who graduated with this type of degree each year. And they were in the math department. In 1958, there was some community funding, and the actuarial program moved to the finance department in the School of Business. And here's something that maybe all of you should know. Actuarial programs in about half of the universities are in the math department, and the other half, they're in the business school. I see an advantage in the math department because I'm in the math department. But there are advantages to being in the business school, too. So the program moved over to the business college, and it was developed in the early 60s. And then Gene Wisdom, I think, really got the program going. These words are from Jim. So the program thrives. And there are 17 students graduating in 1980, and the total enrollment was about 75 students. Also, there's a local actuarial company called Rudd and Wisdom. Get the wisdom part? Here in Austin, and they're big supporters of the program. And I think that's great. Teach here, you know who's good, so you know who to hire. No? It's just me? So it was still in the finance department. And then Sam Cox, who's currently at the University of Manitoba in Canada, but it was in the finance department, headed the actuarial program for about 3 years. And again, the local actuarial community, I think in, was 1984 or 5, got the Paul V. Montgomery Endowed Professorship created. So here's the, maybe it was around 1986, and then Pat Brockett, who is still here, he's in the business school. He headed the program for 3 years, and Pat told me all the details, but in 1989, the finance department, the School of Business, didn't want to have anything to do with actuarial studies anymore. And Jim Daniel came to save the day. And also, so they didn't want to have the program, but all of the local community raised, $500,000, like 2 years earlier. That gets some community upset, right? So this is the ancient history of the program.
Do you have time for an ancient history question?
Yeah, sure. I don't know any answers. But
I think Ralph Lane left to go to Iowa State, and that's when the business school stepped in.
Okay, oh, so...
In 57.
Is that right? In 57?
You may know that. I'm pretty sure that's Ralph Lane left.
Lane. Well, thank you. Other questions or comments? So then Jim directed the program for 22 years, 20-some number of years, until August 31st of 2010. Are there 31 days in August? I think. Is that right? And okay, there was, I would consider, exceptional growth under Jim. But here's more of a snapshot. In 2000, and I think Leslie can corroborate this, so there was growth in students, but there was just Jim teaching the actuarial classes. Just him. So that's, I mean, there weren't any other people teaching the classes. And I'll talk more about the classes. And I think he taught two classes a semester. So they're going to be for a life contingency sequence and for this advanced statistics sequence. And
he was teaching interest
theory.
Rotating it so that not basically every 2 years each of the classes would be taught.
Yeah.
But not necessarily each year.
And then in 2000, we have a small master's program. Our master's program goes off the strength of the undergraduate program. So five of the classes meet with five of the same classes that undergraduates take, if that makes sense. And there were the program supported four teaching assistants each year when it was started. And at least initially, that's all that Jim would accept, was four students each year. Now, there have been a few years where some students were accepted but not being supported. And last year, for example, we had 48 people apply to the program. And we accepted 7 and 4 came, if that makes sense. Now, of those 48, not all were qualified. Some were even overqualified, if this makes sense. So here's kind of some students might go to an actuarial program at another school and then want to come to our master's program, but they're overqualified because they've already taken our courses, so we wouldn't accept them. And also, if they were really good, I think most of them would get actuarial jobs in the first place. So the neat thing is the master's program is small, but they tend to be some of the best students that we have.
Yeah, you get some really good ones.
Yeah, not all. We're not batting 100. Well, whatever. We're not N for N. That's true. And then in 2000, so Leslie began teaching interest theory in, was around 2000 or so?
It was 2000, and I think you're missing one figure that I gave you, because I couldn't give it definitely. In 2000, when I first taught it, there were 45 students.
Oh.
So interest theory, the ACF, then it was 309 class. Met once a year, once each spring,
mm-hmm.
and I had 45 students, and that was fairly consistent with what Jim had had the previous few years.
Okay.
What do the sums mean?
The sums are two sections, one at 27, one at 39. You don't know my codes? Do I need to have a little... okay.
The numbers being reported are actually somewhat late in the term numbers.
Right. So... here's a joke. Do you know that 87% of all statistics are made up right on the spot? Anyway, so these numbers are mostly accurate. Can we just say mostly accurate?
But
some.
I don't understand. Is this one course?
Yeah, this is just interest theory.
And is that one course, or is it a sequence, or is
and it's one course.
One term class. It was back in 2000 and was under. Division class, and in 2003, I think we switched it to be a new course number and to have upper division
credit.
But the content of the class did not significantly change when that decision was made.
I'm going to come back to this slide,
there are little changes in the curriculum that have come to reflect changes in what the credentialing societies want in some of their tests. So
this is taken from the Society of Actuaries website, and these are the hoops that students need to jump through to get those letters after their name. So in the white, if you do these 10 items, you get to become an associate in the Society of Actuaries. So even though there's not really an order, the first one is called Exam P, and it's on calculus-based probability. And the class that our students take that cover most of the materials at Math 362K covers about 80% of the material that's on the exam. Students will still have to prepare a couple hundred hours outside of class to give themselves a chance to pass. So that's kind of the first class, but well, we have 9 different sections of that. The Math 362K class serves lots and lots of people. Then the second one, here's another, it's called Exam FM. Originally, I'm not making this up, it was the mathematical finance exam. But people are pretty uptight at the SOA, and they didn't want students saying, I just took the MF. So that really, that's why they changed it. That's the reason. So that's, I like to call it interest theory. And here's the example. If you go buy a house, you probably don't have the $200,000 for the house, so you take out a loan. And what's your monthly payment going to be? The math isn't hard, it's just some geometric series. And that's the second week question, right? It's not all of it, but that's what we do in interest theory. In calculus-based probability, I tell students if they took 4 exams, they could tell me what their average is. They'd add up the 4 exams and divide by 4, the algebra-based. But I might want to know on average when somebody dies. I get to talk about death a lot. That's what I get to do. And you don't die at age 80. It's 80 point something. So I'll need to, that's where the calculus-based comes in. I don't know much about the financial economics segment. Milica Chudina teaches a class that covers most of the material on this exam, MFE. There's an exam called MLC, which is life contingencies. Here's the example. You come to me, I'm a life insurance company, and I promise to pay your beneficiaries $100,000 when you die. Sorry, not when you die, not at the moment probably. Probably like the end of the month that you die or something around there. Well, on the insurance company, I don't need $100,000. I need to have the present value of $100,000 that will grow with interest. It'll be $100,000 when you die. And if I knew when you were going to die in this class, I could figure out what the present value is. But I don't know when you're going to die, so I have to do an expected value. So the life contingencies is really a combination of the first two classes. And here's the neat thing. How many requirements for this ASA would you say there are? For Candy? No, there are 9. Because, very much like option 3, these two count as one, even though they're two totally different exams. I don't know why.
So I don't get candy.
You already have 2 candy. Anyway.
I know why. They used to be a single exam. Oh. And then they decided it was a 5-hour exam, and there were too many people failing it, and they decided to divide it.
So now those people fail 2 exams instead of just 1.
Oh, okay. But you have 2 fees.
Well, yeah. But it's the same thing, just like in our guise, it's how can we... So it was a travel time issue. It's how can we get that 4-year graduation rate closer? Really? I know, easy. Recruit better people. Okay.
Requirements are a function of time, too. It's long-standing. There's a sequence of exams, but what their content is changes over time, which is one of the challenges for us who teach in it. For instance, the FM exam back in 2000 consisted of a year of economics, term of finance, and interest theory. And now it consists of interest theory and actually, you didn't mention it, but a little bit of financial economics, learning about what financial derivatives are and such. So they try and fluctuate depending on what they think that they want their early, their actuaries all to know.
Our courses cover the content, or at least most of the content, for all 5 of the top exams. Very briefly, students also have to get validation by educational experience, which means take college courses and get at least B minuses, and then you get credit for this instead of taking an exam like you would for probability or something. You could also take an exam, but getting B minuses in micro and macroeconomics easier than passing a test. There's a VE in corporate finance, that's Finance 357. We offer a class, Gustavo Sapero offers a class that meets the VEE in applied statistics. And So maybe some students could have eight of those things. Our best students could have eight of those boxes checked by the time they graduate. I think they probably need to have two exams passed to get an actuarial job. And most of our good students would probably have like three exams. I'm waving my hands, but that's about it. I don't know about the fundamentals of actuarial practice. The professionalism course is great. It's 2 days. It's on a weekend. You're graded if you show up, and then you're done and have a letters after your name. So that's my favorite. And then, so that's just for the ASA. To get the highest credential, an FSA, a fellowship, you get to choose the type of track. So the exams are related to the type of work that someone would do. So if someone is working in group insurance, then they would take these exams. And there are a few more. They're not on the, it doesn't really matter. Does that make sense? And if someone were working in life insurance, they would probably take these exams.
So these are in addition to those?
Oh, yeah. So yeah, you have to be an associate and then do those items. And you saw the numbers, right? So there'd be, at any one time, there are very few students taking these upper-level exams. Right? Now, and I'm going to go back to that one page, but I want to talk about our classes that we have that are related to the exams. For exam P, the SOA calls the first exam, exam P. The Casualty Actuarial Society calls it course one. It's the same test. So students don't have to make up their mind as sophomores or something. And my little note is, I think the class covers about 80% of the material, which is fine. Students are expected to study more on their own. It's fine. And currently, for the FM exam, interest theory, this ACF 329, which is probably the first time we get our hands on the students. Does that make sense? They've taken calculus and maybe calculus-based probability, but I have not seen the students in class. Leslie hasn't. Militza hasn't. Shinko hasn't. And in 2005, when there was a little change, there was some material added, which is in this one credit class that was offered maybe once a year. It's not required for graduation. It's kind of a pain. The one credit. So we want to get rid of this one credit class. Grow the material into a three credit class. About half of the material will go towards the FM exam, and the other half of the material will go to this financial economics exam. That's our current thought. That's in the discussion stage. Only amongst the five faculty, right? So that's where we are. For learning, for exam MLC, we have this 339U and V. It's a year-long sequence for life contingencies. For the C4 exam, we also have a two-semester sequence. It's weird. The first semester's in the spring, and the second semester's in the fall. And I'm sure it's all kind of legacy of how Jim needed to do it to offer the courses. And so these are the main courses that we teach that are tied to the actuarial exams. And so again, I'm going back to the 55. Of those 55 students, maybe only 10 are going to take all the classes, or 15 or 20. It really, ideally, it would be all of our students take all of the classes, but that's not how our life works.
But our best students sometimes have finished them all by the end of their junior year.
Yeah. Yes.
They're best both in terms of if they're very motivated and if they got into it as freshmen or sometimes sophomores.
Kind of the nightmare student is filled out of an engineering program and is here as a junior, and their parents said, oh, actuarial or something. And they still want to graduate in three terms. And if they fail that engineering, they probably won't do well in our program. With an occasional exception, right? I can't make blanket statements. I mean, I can. I'll be right lots of the time.
We do get a lot of these people from engineering.
All right. So I'm going... I guess so. 2, 4, 5, 6. How do we count the? We don't count Math 362K. About seven or eight courses. Then in 2006, Buck Consultants funded part of Dr. Valor's salary to do some program support. And in 2008, Milica started teaching some actuarial classes, and I think that's when... So, for example, she has been the only person to teach this course that covers the MFE material. I want to change that. We're going to get to my goals. One of my big goal is to not rely have to rely on anybody. Well, did I say that right? Okay. Well, I want to have contingency plans, for example. If Jim would have gotten sick in 2000, I think there would have been trouble. Because now none of the material is hard. A lot of it's kind of fun. The material isn't hard, but you have to get used to it and the symbols, the terminology.
It's a different language,
yeah.
And it's different from teaching mathematics.
Oh, so we're already down to my goals. So one of my biggest goals is to recruit more faculty to teach, and those of us who are teaching to teach the other classes. And so this year, Shinko, and next semester, Jennifer Mann is going to teach a section of interest theory. And interest theory is accessible, if that makes there's a little bit of calculus, and then just some time. All right? And we're still experiencing some growth. I went to this talk that Mark arranged with Dean Lottie. I would expect probably even more growth, even if we didn't do anything. With this reason, the university is accepting more students, like 1,000 more students. There are only 2 or 3 schools that kind of have an open enrollment policy, and the College of Natural Science is one of them. So those added students will come to us or go to, what was the other one that he?
Liberal Arts.
Is there another one, like General Studies or something?
UGS.
UGS, whatever that is. So I think the profession is an attractive profession, and we don't have any bars to keep out the weak. So I still would expect some growth. And let's see if we can see that growth. A lot of the stuff that I did. Oh no, that's. But, okay. I don't know why, and it's probably too small for you to see anyway, but I got this data to help me predict enrollments in future classes, if that makes sense. So, and it's so hard to see, and it was originally 90 degrees this way, but in the fall, so let's just do this. In fall of 2008, for example, we had 2 sections of interest theory, total enrollment of 75. And we had 2 sections of the first semester of that life contingencies material, 76 students. And 1 section of this class for another exam, MFE, that Judina taught. And in the second semester class, there were 45 students. So we can, and then in the spring, there were some different classes offered with different enrollments. But some things that I want to point out, the last 3 semesters of interest theory, the enrollments have been whatever they've been. I have asterisks because there were waiting lists. So even though the enrollments were 83, they're really more than 83. For the first time last summer, we offered a section of interest theory. And it hadn't ever been offered in the summer before. I don't know how many students. 23 initially registered. 16 ended up completing the course. And Leslie agreed to, I was thinking about teaching it this next summer. The interesting thing about that course in the summer, what type of audience would you expect? So it's an interest theory class just like we offer in the fall or the spring. But if students are taking it in the summer, they tend to need to take that course in the summer. So maybe they transfer and they want to not waste a whole semester, because the interest theory is often a prerequisite for all the other classes. So I would expect a high QDF rate in that summer. Not knowing anything else, I would expect that. But also, just like probably any summer class, I don't know what the experience is in all the summer classes. Now, sometimes there's some excellent students, right, who want to get ahead. But, yeah. So we're going to try to offer that class again in the next summer. But I certainly think that we need to offer more than two sections a semester, at least in the fall. Those are my biases. We had a class called Seminar in Actuarial Practice that we're not going to offer anymore. Some speakers would come, some actuaries would come and talk about various things, like professionalism and actuarial ethics and consulting skills. So there was a one-credit class, but the students liked to take that class because there was also a one-credit intensive writing component class associated with it. And so that was the attraction. Well, those one-credit writing flag classes don't exist anymore. So we're not going to offer the seminar that goes with a class that doesn't exist anymore. However, the same speakers are invited to come and talk to our club, doing the same sorts of things.
What's happening with 349P? Enrollments are actually going down.
Okay. Yes, I happened to that. So that's the so here are some things. And this is Jim, and this is me. So he's three times better than me. So a couple of things. It's offered at 8:00 in the morning. I am going to go further. I mean, so I think that got it down to like 28. The second thing is, I have goals for my students other than just learning content to pass some stupid exam. I told you that they need to work on communication skills, and so I want my students to present. I want them to take ownership of the material, and when I let them know this, so for example, the first day of class there were 28, then the second week of class there were 17. Also, there's going to be, the way it's currently offered, that's the second semester of a class, and it's offered in the fall. So I think even though we offered the class that feeds us, there are two sections. These two classes feed this one class. So there were 70 students. But of those 70 students, many of them graduated in May. Does that make sense? So I think there's going to be some more attrition just kind of naturally. But really, I happened to this class.
There's another change that we should, in your defense, add.
No, I want them out. Okay.
And that is, there were some adjustments in the requirements of what were needed for the degree. And so there was a little bit more flexibility of choosing classes. And that could have influenced somewhat what people were doing. It used to be, for instance, that the J was a required class. And right. Now
right. But this is the P class, and I don't think the P class, it was never required. But
no, it wasn't. Yeah. But since we were having fewer
right. people with the P. All right, so that's recent enrollment figures. And let's see what's... Okay, then a page intentionally left blank. Do you guys have questions?
I have one.
Yes.
In your process of broadening your students beyond the parent exam, did they learn anything about the origin of the insurance industry in London and Lloyd's of London and all that? Okay. I've asked several actuarial students and none of them have any idea what I'm talking about.
Either do I. So the answer to that question is no. But that is great. So, and that's something that we would like to... I would like to be able to offer other things. Actuarial studies isn't just materials for certain exams. We didn't do anything about rate making. I mean, there's lots of things that we could do. And I'm sure that we could offer something under the Math 398 something. We could do such a thing, but we don't.
In 358K, I tried to get them to do a project where they compare actuarial students to people in European history to see which one knows about the formation of Lodges in London. And I can't ever get one to compare to a survey comparison, which I think would be great.
You're going to be invited to talk to our student club, I'm just saying. No, there are lots of things. There are absolutely lots of things. But again, going back to, say, the snapshot 11 years ago when Jim was here, you can only do so much. And that's true everywhere, right? That is true everywhere. And we want to require more writing. We want our students to do more writing, which is a little bit hard to do if there are 52 students in a class. I want students to do presentations. It's a little bit hard to do with the 52 students. You can do lots of things, right? You don't have to have them do it to everybody. I have nice groups of four, and I can have them work together.
One other piece of ancient history. I think Walter Schur was the most famous graduate that Ralph Lane turned out.
Okay.
You know who Walter Schur was?
I know the name. Why don't I?
Executive Vice President of New York College.
All right.
Very impressive.
Gene Wisdom in 1990 compiled a list of all of the graduates. I have their names. So there's lots of work that I could do. I'd like to have all their names. Here's some bad things that happen in the actuarial industry. Like companies merge, right? So email addresses change, people move, people get married. I mean, just a whole bunch of stuff. It's hard to keep track of our alums. But that's really important. We try to communicate with them with the newsletter and asking them for donations, those sorts of things. And I see smiles of other people who want to ask my students for donations. I got it. I understand. You're not alone. The dean of the College of Natural Science is next, and the president, and then, all right. So are there other questions? Do you have ideas?
I was wondering, how do students typically decide they want to go into the actuarial for a year recruit, or, how do they find out about it?
Yeah. So yes, we recruit. So in the summer, people who think they're interested in any of the math degrees come every Tuesday or whatever, and Mark and I talk to incoming freshmen. In the past, Jim and I have sent letters to incoming business school students who have a 700 on their math SAT. The people in the business school give us their names, and we talk, well, here's something, I don't want you to change your major, but here's something that you might be interested in. We do some information.
They would have to change their major.
No, it's easy for students to take our classes. It's hard for our students to take business classes.
We have some of them who double major. We have some of them who stay business majors.
Mm-hmm. And just to pass the exams. Right?
Yeah, that's right. A year ago, I would say our best student didn't get a degree from here. He was about 35, and his degree was in music. And I would say by far he was our best student. I don't even think it was close. And he ended up, I think he was working towards another bachelor's degree, but he had a nice offer, and then he was done.
Most of our students are, you look at your roster in an interest-theory class, and you kind of laugh out quietly because you'll see that there are 85% of them say they're actuarial science majors, and you know they've never taken a class in the subject, and most of them don't really know what it is.
Right. I was hiding this slide. These are just some thoughts as I write down. But mainly, if you guys have questions or do you have any ideas? You don't have to read this. This was next.
Well, to me, one of the most interesting things you said is that of the 55 graduates a year, 20 become actuaries.
Yeah.
Which means that if we have in mind teaching the students we actually have for the actual futures they live, then as you've been saying, focusing on take-home lessons that go beyond the particular potential profession of actuarial skills is really important.
I didn't use those words, but I wish I would have. All right, thank you. Yeah. But it is, and I should find out what other students do. Dennis, I knew Dennis couldn't get an actuarial job, Mensa, But so he's trying to get an underwriting job, which is still in the same type of company, and so maybe he can move.
We've had quite a few who have taken jobs in human resources in companies that have actuarial positions. Sometimes with a promise that if they actually do pass exams, they'll be considered when an opening comes up, although it's a rarity that they end up making that move. Yeah. We have quite a few right now who are talking about teaching. We've had several go to Teach for America.
Which makes me sad because I know who the students are, but I'm joking. So, and there are two characteristics to be able to pass these exams. You have to be smart enough, and after giving them a calculus exam or so, I could tell if they were smart enough. But the main thing is it's a work ethic. You really do have to prepare 300 hours for an exam, and that's what gets most of the people. Here are some of my favorite quotes. I'm going to make my money publishing a book on quotes and spelling of other people. But this one student, I'm not going to mention her name. I can mention her name because, anyway, I can't say this anymore. We'll edit that out wrong. Anyway, she left an exam, and she knew she was going to fail the exam. And the exams, they're now offered more regularly, but for a long time, they're only offered every 6 months. So you fail an exam, you get to study for six more months or something. But she was upset because she knew she didn't pass, and she said, those are 3 weeks of my life I'm never going to get back. And I thought that was funny, because if she was only going to prepare for 3 weeks, I knew she wouldn't pass. So she should have talked to me 22 days earlier or something. All right.
Do you have students taking internships?
Yes. Lots.
Does it correlate well with those who actually become actuaries?
I think the correlation is one. If there could be a correlation coefficient more than one, that would be it. Right, as a matter of fact, so these internships, they're nice. They're highly compensated. Students, maybe $20 an hour as a junior or something. But an internship is mainly a three-month job interview. So again, it really is. The companies are making a big investment in the students, so they want to see how they'll work. And I'll know if students are going to update their fantasy team or their Facebook status or whatever, or if they're going to go around and ask to help. I mean, you can see that in 3 months. You can't fib. So ideally, like our seniors, many of our seniors come back and they already have a job offer. And then their biggest problem is they're going to have too many job offers. So there are those complaints. I can't get a job, or I have too many job offers.
There are a few, but not that many examples of students who go for an internship and come back and say, this is the wrong field for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And ideally, students, you probably need an exam to get an internship. So the earlier you start working on your credentialing system, ideally, you might work at an insurance company one summer, and then the next summer work at a consulting company. They're different. Insurance companies, they advertise 37 and a half hour work weeks. You know what you're going to be doing today, tomorrow, next week. Consulting companies, you're consulting other companies. So maybe United Airlines wants to buy Delta Airlines, and they're going to merge pension plans. And I need to have a number of how much this is going to cost me by Monday. So you don't know what you're going to do. So consulting actuaries might work many more hours. Some people like that, some people don't. The nice thing is, once you've been at a company for a while, you have a goal to bill your hours. Like you might want to bill 1,200 hours. And if you exceed that goal, most companies give you a bonus of 40% of your bill rate. And your bill rate is often like $300 an hour. So for each hour above your goal, you're making $120 an hour. So again, my friend, who's no longer an actuary, the same one at the Washington State Silver Miners, there were many, many years in a row where his bonus at the end of the year was more than I was earning the entire year. But he wasn't able to go to all his son's baseball games. And you know, he worked for it, right? So other questions?
I was just curious.
Yes. Right. So for international students, I think it makes them more likely to be hired.
But you don't have any foreign students, right? You're also a foreign student or a master's.
Here, no, there are some foreign students who do masters here, and some American students. It's about half and half. But for, I would say, a good undergraduate, there's no incentive to take a master's program.
You did have a student that worked up, I think, got a master's, and then switched to the math finance program, and then moved into a financial industrial position in New York. So it built on the succession of interests.
Mm-hmm.
We also had a certain number of students who started out in the department as PhD students and who have taken actuarial classes, in some cases continuing and finishing a PhD and maybe even going on and taking an academic position. But in some cases, it's a route for students who realize that they really don't want to do research in mathematics.
Right.
And that rather than leaving without a career path and without feeling like they're a failure, they might give actuarial courses a try. In some cases, they find that they do no better than that than they did with research in mathematics. But in other cases, it's led very nicely to careers in actuary.
I see the master's program as maybe a false, like a soft landing place for some students, and I try to avoid those students. Like in our master's program, we support three or four students. I want to recruit the people who I know are excited about being actuaries and who will be my contacts when they go get these jobs, so I can have them ask whomever for a company donation. Really, that's my goal. I'm selfish. Because, I mean, quite frankly, for three or four master's students, if anything, they're just kind of there's more difficulty with them. Oh, and back just one more thing with these numbers. When I told you that there are some lies, Colleen never lied, but a lot of these classes, there's an associated graduate program that meets with, so I combined the numbers. And so in 51, I probably shouldn't have said 51. I probably should have said something like 46 plus 5. All right? Are we good? All right, thank you. Yay! Candy for everybody.